Let's maybe start recapping a couple of things we saw in the morning. So there were two things we did in the morning. One, we finished this flower example, and the other is we went to the true model that we wanted, which was the self-avoiding walks, where we did not solve the model exactly, because it's a very hard model to solve, in fact. But we came up with an approximation scheme where we said, let's look at a big walk. And whenever we have these blocks, we say this is like going down, then it goes down, then it goes left, then it goes up, then it goes up, then it goes up. So this path, after I zoom out, looks like something like this, right? Man, all the steps should have the same size, right? So, okay. So it looks like something like this. And then I could coarse grain and coarse grain and coarse grain. And if here I add some coupling, some counting parameter, each time I give one step, I put a factor of z. Here, I should put a factor of z prime, where z prime is equal to this. And why is that? Because going up could mean, in the previous case, going really up, up, up. Or it could mean doing some zigzag that costs 3 steps. Or doing an even more complicated zigzag that takes 4 steps. And because there are 4 microscopic paths that lead to the same going up as I zoom out, it's too loud. Because there are a few steps, I add them all up to get my effective step. Right? Now, this effective step is very interesting because then there is a critical point. We detect a critical point, a point here. There was 2 stable points and this unstable point. So I need to tune there to go to very long walks. And in these very long walks, I can now study the vicinity of this fixed point, right? In the vicinity of the fixed point, k prime minus k critical is proportional to k minus k critical by the derivative, right? If I just zoom in and see how they are. On the other hand, the correlation length before and after differ by a factor of 2. I put these 2 ingredients together and I read off that this combination here, right, should be equal to 1, and that gives me nu, the critical exponent, which is the behavior of how the correlation length blows up with nu. And this critical exponent was 0.715, which is not so far away from the exact result. Okay? The only thing we needed to close the logic and to say that what we are computing here is an interesting quantity, right? It's the critical exponent. How does the correlation length blow up with the chemical potential? There was one more step, which is to say this is the same thing. Tuning the chemical potential to go close to the critical value is the same thing as taking paths to be large. So working with fixed chemical potential, but then going close to the critical point is the same as working with big paths, right? And in particular, we saw that the average size of the path was growing like 1 over kc minus k. So this is really n to the nu. So it's really exactly the definition we had before. Any question about this general treatment? Now, this general treatment was somehow also motivated by an exact example that we solved. And I was told that people were complaining that there was a step I did which was a little bit too fast, so I'd like to do it a bit slower now. So let's suppose that I consider this flower example, where I go up, 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 up. And now I'm going to define G in a slightly different way as I did before. I'm going to say that G is a sum of Hn and Vn, where H and V are defined by this recursion relation, where here I put a parameter V, and here I put a parameter H. Notice that the first example we did amounts to just putting V equal H equals Z, because I just count each time I give a step, right? So this is a generalization from V equal H equals Z, right? If I do like this, V equal H equals Z was what I had before. Each time I give a step, I put a factor of z. No? Yeah. So before I add a z to the n here, right? I'm saying remove it from here and put it here. So each time you give a step, you put the factor there. Then it's automatic. It's equivalent. Right? And then this function now would be my generating function that would depend on v and h. And defined like this, what is this? This is equal to a sum over all these paths, right? And then small v to the number of times we went up, small h to the number of times we went left or right in my path, for my corresponding path, right? So this counts both types, right? Where the length of the path, L, is the number of times I go up plus the number of times that we go horizontal and vertical. So if I put Z, V equal to H equal to Z, I go back to the previous example. So this goes back to our correlation function Z of Z. If I put V equal H equal Z, so I don't distinguish vertical and horizontal.
But last time we also put an H when we're trying to find the H bar in the.
Okay, maybe that's going to be super confusing indeed, because H I was using for height.
Yeah.
And now I'm using H for horizontal.
Yeah.
Let's not do that indeed. So what is another synonym for horizontal? Let's
sideways.
Okay, S, sideways. Okay, now it's V sideways. Here we have sideways. And when vertical is equal to sideways is equal to Z, we get back to the previous case. It's like we have two chemical potentials now that control how much the flower wants to grow up and how much the flower wants to spread to the sides.
So last time we had the Z, which is the chemical potential, but then also we added an additional parameter to figure out, to count the number
the v.
of steps. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now...
So this is a generalization from this, and also... It's related to, so first we started with just this case, right? Then we did an example where we had V and Z, which in this new language is like saying that we have V and S, which would be, here we have Z, sorry. So if I go here, right? I can say that this is V to the power of going up times S to the power of going sideways. But S to the power going sideways is the total length minus going up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this combination I can also write as V over S to the power of the number of times I've go up times S to the total length. Right, so now it's of the form that we also played once, where this was what we called Z, and this was what we called V.
Okay.
Right, where we had V for going up, and Z for everything. So this would be how we would map. But forget about what we did before. Let's just do it like this, where whenever I go vertically, I put a V. Whenever I go horizontally, I put an S. Right? That counts everything. And now this sum automatically is equal to vertical to the number of vertical steps, sideways to the number of sideways steps. Do you agree? Is this correct? And so let's see what happens when I compute V ddV of G. Well, this is equal to the sum over paths of number of times I go up, V to the number of steps going up, right? Times sideways to the number of steps I go sideways. Because taking V dV just brings down this number, right? And therefore, V ddV of log of G at V equal S equal Z. Well, it is just this thing divided by Z. It's equal to the sum over paths. This thing, number of times I went up. I put Z V equal S equal Z. So Z to the length divided by sum over all paths. Z to the length. But this is nothing but the expectation value of H, where H is the size of my flower, right? So this is H bar. Is this clear? Similarly, if I were in this toy model, in this example, if I were to do V ddV plus S dds of log G, and then I put V equal S equal to Z, for example, in this example, I would take these two derivatives, and instead of this, right, I would get this plus this, so it's the total length, so I would get the sum over paths of the length z to the l divided by sum of z to the l, but that by definition is the expectation value of the length, so it's what we were calling n bar. I just wanted to do it slowly because apparently people were a bit confused. And of course, we have no term like this in the lecture, but we were up. It's related to just some trivial change of variables. But that's the general logic. Is this clear? Okay. So now the idea. Is to try to think that, so what we want to do next is consider self-avoiding walks in the continuum. Okay, so this lecture is going to be a little bit more advanced now. So I want to give you a flavor of some kind of arguments that I think you will be more ready in a few months when you will have more normalization group in field theory. So this lecture is going to be a little bit more advanced today. So you should try to get a grasp, but you are not meant to understand all the steps very mathematically. It's a little bit harder, I think. Maybe not. But I think it's likely that it's going to be a little bit harder. So what we want to do is to have an Hamiltonian that depends on the configuration. And the configuration now that we want is to have some continuum vector, some position that depends on tau, which is my position. I have some curve, and I am at some point at some tau. I am at some position x of tau, where tau is a parameter along the curve. And we want directly to have an expression for this Hamiltonian as a function of some curve x of tau. And let me write the proposal, and then let's justify this proposal. And the proposal that we want to have this Hamiltonian for the self-avoiding walk, or the action for the self-avoiding walk, let's write it down and then we justify it. It will be an integral over the, let me put x of t, otherwise I will be confused. And I want to call it t because remember, in the random walk, we use t to be the number of steps. So t is the time along, not tau. So we have the integral dt derivative of x with respect to t square plus u a to the d minus 4. A here is the lattice spacing, some cutoff. So I'm saying it's continuum, and I'm using this word lattice spacing. In other words, this is a cutoff. It's an ultraviolet cutoff. If I have to regulate, I say things cannot get as close as A. Times the double integral dt1 dt2, so the second term is, I'm going to write it as a double integral, times a delta function of x of t1 minus x of t2. And so the claim is that the intuition behind this formula is that this stuff, if I set u to zero, this would be the energy for the usual random walk. Okay. How do we see this? Well, I'll explain it a little bit slower, but just remember that in the usual random walk, what was the probability of going from step I to I plus one after we cross grain was a Gaussian. Right? So it was exponential of minus ri plus 1 square. But that's basically e to the minus the derivative square when I take the continuum limit. So So that's like the probability. And what's the probability of going along a big path? It's just the product of many of these probabilities. So I get e to the minus the integral of derivative squared. That's the usual thing with path integral derivation. We do step by step. Each step would be a Gaussian, so each step e to the minus derivative squared. And we do many times, so we end up with e to the integral of the derivative squared.
Can you write that down?
Yeah, I will. I just want to give first the intuition by words, and then we'll write it down. So then this describes this random walk, several steps of the random walk, each of them a small Gaussian, and therefore we get this continuum limit that measures the propagation from one point to the other in the usual random walk. What would be the meaning of this term here? Then, I'm saying now I'm putting some energy penalty here, and what would be the physical interpretation of this term, the second term?
Infinite energy if the path crosses itself.
Right, so we are saying now if the path crosses, it costs lots of energy. So this is like a repulsion. So this is the usual walk, and this says, no, right? Because here it costs infinite energy. So this sounds like a good guess. Let's put just random walk and then put some repulsion that sends the path away and that doesn't allow for self-crossings. Okay, so that's the intuition behind this. So this would be like some repulsion to get no intersections. Okay. So we could take this as definition or proposal, but I would like to motivate to say a few words more about this term because it's a little bit fast. So well, so let's recall a little bit that where does this term come from? And the idea is, so let's say a few words about the origin of the first term. Just to see that things are scaling correctly. So the first term, let's see what we are writing. We are saying the first term is integral dt dx dt square. In other words, if I imagine discretizing this, right? If I imagine discretizing my path, I'm kind of undoing the path integral, then this would be a summation over I r xi plus 1 minus xi square over a square. Okay, let me explain. Let's maybe do it a little bit. And this would be what would come from the product of the probabilities of going from I to I plus 1. If I were to take many, many probabilities from going from this step I to I plus 1. In other words, if I want to count the number of paths that go from one step to the other. But let me just mention something important about, remind you that we had that R square scales like T, right? This we saw in the usual Gaussian random walk, R squared scales like T. In other words, R scales like square root of T. But here it was when we said a step is 1. Let's suppose the step is a instead. Let's put units again here. So r as units of length, so I should put a. But then it means that here I have to put a square. Okay? If I want this formula to be just the same as this. One sec. And therefore, for these formulas to be true, if I say that this guy has dimension 1, t has dimension 2. Okay? In other words, when I quadruple my time, my path only doubles, because my path goes like square root of the time. Right? So the dimensions of my fields are such that T has dimension 2, whereas R, in other words, X, has dimension 1. You agree? And indeed, that is why such expression makes sense and is independent of the lattice spacing, because you see that this guy has dimension 2, this guy has dimension 1, this guy here has dimension 2, so in total we get 2 plus 2, 4, minus 2 times 2, 4 as well, 0. So the dimensions works out that that the full thing has no dimensions. Okay? So everything is dimensionless, so we can say that T is the time measured in units of lattice spacing. So then T, so we can the scaling is correct. So
previous results that we had from the random walks, right?
Yes. Yes. That's right. Okay. So so now we take this as our starting point and we ask what happens to this model. If we start with this model and we do renormalization, namely we zoom out and we ask what is happening to this model.
Sorry, is it this model for unbiased random walk?
This is unbiased random walk.
No, we can't have bias to have the Kinesian limit.
No, that's right. With bias, this would not work. Yeah, just so that, just to emphasize again this point. For example, because of these dimensions, the way it works is that this expression here, right, is what becomes integral dt, if you want to keep units, over a square, right? Then dt has units too, this has no units, and this is what becomes a square times derivative of x with respect to t square. Okay, and you can easily see that indeed, if I were to rescale my step, that's how the two terms would shift. Yeah.
What about the d minus 4 for the a term up in your integral for your Hamiltonian?
Okay, good question. So Jeremy is asking, what about the what about that term there? Right? Let's see that the dimensions are correct indeed. Right? So dt1, dt2, each has dimension 2. So dimension 2 plus 2, 4. Delta function has dimension minus d. So total 4 minus d. Indeed, I put there 8 to the d minus 4. So u is dimensionless. Great question. Right? So good point. U is a good number that we can ask, is it small, is it big, u is dimension. And u equal to 0 means unrestricted random walk. And now we ask, let's turn on u and see if there is a fixed point that describes a new type of walk, which is not the usual random walk. And if it exists, then a new non-trivial model with u would be the self-avoiding walk. Okay. So now the idea is to take u not equal to zero and change our microscopic unit scale, microscopic unit scale, from A to rescale it from B times A. So we rescale what we call the fundamental step by A, by B times A, where B could be 2, like in our previous example. Okay? So we do a rescaling, and we ask, how does the kinetic term change? And how does the repulsion term, and how does the repulsion term change? And so we do the following. So we assume that A scales to B times A, and we say that when A scales like B times A, let R, or let X, sorry, let X scale as B to the minus X times X, B to the minus Y times X, okay? And now what we are going to do is, one, ask what could be Y, and next we will ask what is the connection between this Y and the critical exponent mu, and when we find this relation, we ask what do we predict for our critical exponent mu. So you have to bear with me, let's find what this scaling would predict, this exponent that says, once I rescale my fundamental scale, instead of saying that I look at 1 millimeter is my cutoff is bigger, how do my distances, how my, does my path change? Once we know, it's trivial to relate it to nu, and then we will get a prediction for nu. Okay, so the key, so we change, we rescale A by B times A, X by B to the minus Y times X. So the first term, X is rescaled, and so the first term transforms as B to the minus 2Y times itself. Just it's proportional to X squared, each X picks a factor of B to the minus Y, so in total we get B to the minus 2Y times the kinetic term. What about the interaction term, the repulsion term? So notice, the repulsion term, I shift A by B times A, so the repulsion goes to B to that power over there, B minus 4. But then, there is a delta function there that I have to rescale, and therefore I get B to the D times Y. This is from the delta function, right? Delta function of B times something is, I can take out and remove the delta function, times the repulsion. And then we will now we make a step that is a bit hand-waving. We say that if both terms are important, if both terms scale in the same way, we say we approach a critical point and now both terms are competing, I have the repulsion and the interaction scaling in the same way, because if they are not scaling in the same way, I'm not yet at the critical part, then one is still going to be more important or the other is going to be more important. So if they scale in the same way, the exponents better be the same, and therefore I get that minus 2 times y should be equal to d times y plus d minus 4. In other words, y should be equal to d minus 4 over d plus 2. This is a prediction for what y should be.
In the previous Gaussian model, we also let the t scale rescale, but now we don't.
No, in the usual random walk, y would be 0. Precisely because r is independent of the lattice spacing. R just goes like t. Agree? You agree, everyone? Let me emphasize here, in the usual random walk, we have that r squared just goes like t, which is independent of a, and therefore y there is equal to 0. That's the trivial fixed point. But now we are studying this non-trivial fixed point, trying to find it, saying that it's an fixed point where both terms are important. But d plus 2, 4 minus d, yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, Pedro, can you explain what is the physical meaning of y? I still can't get it because...
So I'm saying that as I change my, as I integrate out degrees of freedom, as I'm going from the fundamental scale being 1 millimeter to being 5 millimeters. Now that's what I call the new one. That's my new unit.
Are you doing for all
what is, yeah, for all dimensions. So what is, how does my x change? So if my path is ballistic, say, for example, imagine it's just a line and my path is just ballistic, right? And I say, I change my fundamental line from before it was, the length was 100. Right? But 100 what? 100 centimeters. Now I change my unit from 1 centimeter to 5 centimeters. The length changed by a factor of 1/5 because now I have 5 less. Then y would be 1, for example. Right? I multiply by 5 my fundamental scale. My total size divides by 5.
So x depends on your path, I would say. Like, if it's not a straight line, then it won't be like y.
Right, I'm saying that I have my model where I chose to describe the model at some scale, A. Then I have some Hamiltonian, some energy for each configuration. Someone else decides to study the model at a length scale that differs by that one by a rescaling of B. That second person should use a field that is also rescaled so that we have the same physics. What is the rescaling factor? We don't know yet, we call it Y. And then we say, if we want a fixed point, and if we want both points to be equally important, interaction and repulsion, they better scale in the same way, and then y should be equal to this factor. Yeah? Notice, for example, when d is equal to 4, y is equal to 0, which is what we expect, because we said that when d is bigger or equal than 4, the self-avoiding walk is equal to the random walk. So it's already nice that when d is equal to 4, we are recovering the random walk. Because then y is 0, which is what we said here. Okay. But let's be a bit slower. Let's see that. Now, so this is what we did here. But now next, and I think this will make you happy, let's relate what we just computed to the critical exponent. New? How? We just say that now I have my x. Well, my expectation value of x is a by dimensions. And then some function of t over a squared, because t has dimension 2. This is just dimensional analysis. Right? And this, we are saying, behaves as if f of x, I want f of x to behave as x to the new, right? Because then this behaves as a to the power 1 minus 2 nu times t to the nu. Right? So if I want nu to be related to the size of the path, then f should scale like this. You agree? Just scaling argument. But this, how does it change when I scale a to b times a? Well, a is here, right? A is here. So this changes by b to the 1 minus 2 nu times what is here already, a to the 1 minus 2 nu, t to the nu, which is x. Right? And therefore, this quantity here is minus y. Right? So that's how we relate y to nu. So the relation between, so we have y equal to this, and we just derived that nu is equal to 1 minus y over 2. 1 minus y over 2. Sorry? Not correct?
1 plus y over 2.
1 plus y over 2. Thank you. So you see, again, let me emphasize. So let's look at this expression. X goes like a times f of t over a squared. How would it scale like square root of t if this function f is square root of this dimensionless quantity? Then this quantity scales like square root of t. And then a drops out. And indeed, when nu is equal to 1/2, a drops out, then y would be 0. Right? That's the usual box. And we see that here, when is y 0? Y 0 when d is equal to 4. So when d equal to 4, this gives the same exponent as the usual self-avoiding walk. Otherwise, it gives this box. And this gives, let's put a final box in a different color, because now we combine two boxes. And we get, finally, this nu. And we get that nu, according to this estimate, is 3 over d plus 2. Okay. And this is an awesome estimate. This is a very good estimate. So let's see this expression. So this, what I just described, is what's called Flory's result. So let's say nu, let's put an f from this guy, Flory. And this is say that this exponent is 3 over d plus 2. And let's write a few results and see that things are okay. So when d is equal to 1, we get 1, or d equal 1. That's good, because self-avoiding walk, if I'm in one dimension, I start going to the right, I need to go always to the right, so it's ballistic. Right? So it should be 1. Do you agree? One dimension, I start going, I cannot stop. I just go linearly with the number of steps. Right? So of course it's okay. D equals to 2 gives 3/4 for d equals to 2. You see 0.75 that we were working so hard to get the wrong results, and now we hand wave a little bit and we get the exact result. Okay. So that's not bad, that's true. Then we get 3/5, which is 0.6 in d equals 3. Now the exact result is 0.59, so it's also not bad. It's not 0.59, it's 0.5878. It rounds to 0.59. So this is not correct. And then in d equals 4, we are getting 1/2, which is the random walk, and that's correct. So you see, it's not a bad estimate, right? It gives 0.6 instead of 0.69 in 3D, otherwise it gives all values right.
We didn't make any approximations here, right?
Good question. Did we make any approximation? We did. We didn't make an approximation because what would be the analog of the approximation we did in the morning? In the morning, we said no new couplings are generated. And here as well, we could say, as I zoom out, right, there could be paths where before I had more than the path would pass by some circle, by some sphere, the path could pass there three times. And if I remove that path, now to describe that bigger unit, I need a new coupling that would be like a delta function when three positions of the path are together. So when we started integrating things out, you could ask, why don't we generate new couplings in this Hamiltonian? Why don't I start, as I zoom out, increasing more terms that says there is an energy penalty when three positions of the path are close, and then when four, and then when five? Why aren't we putting these extra terms and being more careful? And it so turns out, for very deep reasons that I don't know how to prove actually, that in D equals two, those terms cancel out by some hidden supersymmetry of the model. And so it's kind of luck that it works out. So Cardi says that in his book, but I don't know the story. But apparently we were lucky that this is exact, because there are mistakes in both directions that turn out to cancel. But it's kind of luck in this case, but it's the exact result. And in D equals three, it's so close to this numerical result that you could wonder if the numerical result is wrong and if the exact result is 3/5 as well. Right? And the answer is no. The numerics are okay. It's 0.59. And I'll tell you in a little bit why.
Is it exactly 0.59?
No, it's 5.878, whatever. But it rounds to 0.7. Okay. Now, this argument was perhaps a little bit tough, but I wanted to show you so that you would see an example of a field theory where we do some RG argument directly in field theory. But let's recover exactly the same results using a much simpler argument. And I would say that this is the quantum field theory argument, and now let's do the chemist argument. Okay? And it's also good, and it will look much simpler. And I want to show you to then emphasize that it's exactly the same thing. And therefore, you should not think that this is complicated. You should think that that one is simpler than you first thought. But well, let's see what I mean by this. So the idea is to think that, to try to think of a polymer that is here. This polymer doesn't self-intersect. And there will be some energy cost versus some entropy. And the idea is to try to balance both, balance them, to fight one against the other. And when we balance, to find how R scales with N such that the two terms balance each other, which would be the equilibrium condition. Okay, so let's try to work out the entropy first. So for the entropy, we did this, we assume that we have just a usual random walk. What is the entropy for the random walk? We computed already. But we did it in a different way. We computed the probability of the random walk for a given size R, right? What is that? It's a Gaussian. But what's that probability? It's the number of walks that have size R divided by total number of walks, right? So total number of walks is just a number, I don't care. So the exponent of the Gaussian is the entropy of the usual random walk. Okay, so slower. So if this has some distance R, the entropy as a function of R is the logarithm of the number of states that go from 0 to R, which is nothing but the probability of going from 0 to R times 2d to the n, right? It's the denominator, which is the total number of paths of n steps, but that's a constant, doesn't depend on R. And this probability is a Gaussian, and so this entropy is R square times a constant. Right? The probability is a Gaussian plus some constant. This is e to the minus. Okay? Happy? So that's just saying that if you increase r, the entropy goes like r squared. Okay, what about the energy? So that's the entropy. What about the energy? The energy we write, we assume that there is some concentration. So let's write C to be some concentration of monomers. So the polymer is made of many monomers. So this would be the total, the concentration. One second, yes?
Yeah, I don't understand why that scales as r squared.
Because it's log of exponential of r squared.
Is it a minus sign?
Ah, yeah, maybe there is a minus. It's not important.
Why is the probability a Gaussian? Because
that was the result, right? For the random walk, we take a random walk, this probability of going from 0 to r was a Gaussian. Okay. Now, what would be this concentration of monomers if I have n monomers, 1 up to n, 1, 2, 3, so on. This concentration of monomers would scale as n over r to the d, where d is the number of dimensions, just total number of particles divided by the volume. And what is the energy? The energy would be related, if there is some repulsion between the particles, right? It's related to the probability, to the product of the density. It's related to the density square, because this measures how many times do two points get close to each other. And so the energy, right, would be proportional to c squared times the volume. It's an estimate, right? Just the probability of interacting that can happen at any point in the box. And therefore, it would scale as n squared over r to the d. Okay, and therefore, now we have a competition between energy minus entropy, and this would be our free energy, that would be some constant times n over r to the d, to the 2 to the d, minus plus, there is a minus, and there was a minus that someone pointed out, some constant times r squared. Right? You agree? That would be my free energy, which is a function of r. And therefore, we minimize the free energy. Minimizing f gives me df dr equals 0, which is equal to some constant divided by r. to the d plus 1, right? Plus some constant times r. Ah, I did a mistake. N square, and then I put n here, it was n square. N square. Sorry, 1 second. Ah, I forgot an important thing. Sorry. Good. Remember what was the probability of going from 0 to r? It's good that people ask. So it's a Gaussian, right? If we do t steps, what were we getting? If I remind you, that this probability after t steps was e to the minus x squared over 2t sigma squared. Right? Do you remember? This was the very first factor. So this t, I forgot here, over n. Okay? So sorry. So this, there is an over n here. Let's continue. Over n. Right? And therefore, by comparing both, we conclude that r scales like n to the 3 over d plus 1. And this is exactly the result that we got before. Okay? Does it work? N cube, r d plus 1, d plus 2, yeah. Okay? Now, this looks much, I think, probably this looks much simpler, right? We just had some entropy, number of paths we computed before. We estimated the energy, it's just the density squared times the volume, right? The number of times, it's how we would do in chemistry right away. So how could this be much simpler than before? It's not, it's exactly the same thing. The delta function part is the concentration square, it is just measuring how many times they interact. The scaling that we did there is just the estimate, the correct estimate of dimensional analysis. And the fact that we have the right entropy is also encoded in having the right kinetic term for the random walk that we justified that was correct, and now we see one more evidence that it was not a mistake. So it's all exactly equivalent. It's just that there it's in a very field theoretical language, and here is more in a chemist way. And Flory, who was a chemist, actually derived it in this way first. So that way there is how Cardi does in his book. So and it's exactly equivalent. It's not different. Okay, so if ever you are confused about that, don't forget that it's exactly equivalent to this. It's not another derivation. It's the same derivation for people of different tastes. So it just depends. I like this more, but some people will for sure like that more. Okay, but it's absolutely equivalent. Now, given that it's so spectacular, we could ask, could this new Flory, could this be exact? Right? Well, I mean, it looks not bad. Okay. Now, again, what was the mistake? We said that there could be a mistake there. What was the mistake here? What was the mistake? Here there were two mistakes. Two oversimplifications. One is that we said the energy is just the concentration square. But what's that? That's basically saying that the only thing that matters is when they meet in pairs. But as we said, it could be three at the same time, could be meeting, four could be meeting. We are underestimating the energy. We are saying just when two repel. But what about multiple times? What if they collide many times? So we are underestimating. But we are doing another mistake that cancels that mistake. Which is, when we are estimating the entropy, we are using the entropy of the usual random walk. But the correct walk is a bit smaller. It's a bit bigger, sorry. The correct walk is a bit bigger. So we are also underestimating the entropy. And the two effects are canceling each other such that we are getting the right result, at least in D equals 2. Yeah. But it's really, if it was not so close to the experimental results that people observe in the lattice when they study polymers, I think people would say, oh, this is probably wrong. There are effects you are ignoring. But given that it's so good, because as I said, it matches exact results in D equals 2, and it almost agrees with D equals 3, we could ask whether it is exact. So how could we try to check if it's exact or not? So D equals 1 and D equals 4, it works. D equals 3 is too hard. D equals 2, okay, maybe it's luck. So how could we go about checking this? And the idea is simple, but ingenious, which is to consider what this gives close to four dimensions, if D is 4 minus epsilon. So let's suppose we're very close to four dimensions. So we think of D as a continuous parameter, and we go to 4 minus epsilon. Well, then this prediction says that the result is 1 half minus epsilon over 12 plus order epsilon squared. Hey, you can just expand D around 4 minus epsilon. Yeah, we can even see it by head. It's correct, right? Okay. It's actually... However, remember that Nis knew there was a relation between the self-avoiding walks that we probably already forgot, that we saw it in one of the lectures. There is a relation to the ON model, right? Now, the ON model, in four dimensions, the walk becomes random, which you should expect that the ON model becomes the Gaussian model. In other words, if you are in four dimensions, the field theory is easy to describe. It is just the Gaussian model that we know how to describe very well. So if we are close to four dimensions, it's like doing perturbation theory close to the Gaussian model. And indeed, this can be done. And we can take the ON model, go close to four dimensions, see that what we get is the Gaussian model plus a small perturbation, which is 4 minus epsilon, which is 4 minus D, which is epsilon, and do study the ON model in that perturbation parameter. And so we can compute nu of the ON model in D equals 4 minus epsilon. Okay, and what we get is I don't have it here, so I will try to say it by head. It must be something like this. So it must be n minus 2. Okay. I think the result you get is 1 half plus epsilon times it plus order epsilon squared. I'm not positive about this. I'm positive it's wrong. I think there's probably over 4, something like that. But this equal sign, I'm not sure. The equal sign I'm going to write here, I know. So we could go to the ON model. And like I said, if D is close to 4, we can study the ON model exactly, because it becomes just n Gaussian fields. And so the result is 1 half, which is the Gaussian field result, plus some correction that depends on n. Now that we are already taking number of dimensions to be some funny number, we can furthermore take n, the components of the vector, to go to 0. And then now we send n to 0. And when we send n to 0, we get 1 half plus epsilon over 16. Okay? And 16 is not 12. Okay? And therefore, this expression is wrong. Because this one is supposed to be the correct one by the duality to the ON mod. Okay? So that's the first evidence that we know. We know that it starts at 1/2. I'm writing, okay. It starts at 1. This is the dimension. When D is 1. When D is 4, it starts at 1. When D is 4, it goes to 1/2. When D is 3, it passes by the correct value of 3/4 here. No, sorry. When D is 2, it passes by the correct value of 3/4. Then it is some function that does like this. That's the value that we are getting. This would be nu of Flory. This would be 0.6, right? That Flory predicts. We are saying that the correct value is not 0.6, it's a bit below. So here would be 0.59. So we are saying it's a little bit smaller. It's not 0.6. The correct result is a little bit smaller. And indeed, we find some evidence, because if we start here and shoot in this direction, we are predicting that we go with a slope epsilon over 12, and the correct result is a bit smaller slope, epsilon over 16. Okay? So indeed, in the vicinity here, we know that the correct result should be 1/2 minus epsilon over 16, which is not the same as 1/2 minus epsilon over 12. Right? And therefore, we know that, indeed, we could have guessed that perhaps, based on this analysis, the correct result is a little bit down, and that's indeed what we would have said. Right? So just from this analysis, you could say, well, 0.6 might be a little bit too much. Try 0.59. And then you would try, and the experimentalist would find exactly 0.59. Now, of course, then you could ask, okay, so what is the exact result in D equals 3? Then, if it's not 0.6, what is this number, 0.59? Is it some exact number, some algebraic number, or something like that? And people don't know. It's not solved. Self-avoiding walks in three dimensions is not solved. So we don't know what this number is. Perhaps it's just whatever it is. Perhaps it's not exactly computable, but it's a critical exponent that we don't know what it is. So I would like to conclude this discussion of self-avoiding walks with a scaling argument. So scaling arguments are very powerful in physics and in chemistry, and I find this one very beautiful, so I wanted to tell you a bit about it. And again, it's a little bit advanced, and it's a little bit off the general topic, but I find it really impressive how we could predict something for a gas of polymers, for a solution of polymers. Now we imagine that we have a bunch of polymers, and we put them in a box. We put a solution of polymers in a box, and we ask, what's the pressure, for example, of this solution? Pi. Pressure that will depend on the concentration of these polymers, and on n. N would be the number. Each of them would have 1, 2, 3 would have size n. 1, 2, 3 up to n. So we have some concentration of polymers. So this pressure here would depend on the concentration of polymers and on how many monomers they have. And we have a bunch of polymers. Okay. So let me ask again whether these type of arguments are okay, or if you want me to summarize, because now this one is a little bit more sophisticated. So if there is any question here, if this is already hard, this is going to be a little bit harder, but not much. It's also independent of this. So it's harder, but it's independent. So even if you did not understand everything, you have a second chance. Okay.
I had a question. About this comparison that you did.
Yeah.
So, as I understand, the idea was we are using the ON model to check whether, because there's a duality between
that's right.
wording walk and.
That's right. So there is a duality. That duality is exact.
Yeah.
But often it doesn't help me, because even if there is a duality, you ask me, okay, so now use the ON model in three dimension. And I don't know how to solve the ON model in three dimension. It's too hard. Right, so the ON model is still a complicated model. It's like Ising model in 3D, right? We don't know how to solve. So if someone tells me my model is dual to the 3D Ising model, I say, okay, congratulations. All right, what is this useful for? We don't know how to solve that model. Except if you are close to four dimensions, because close to four dimensions, the ON model is basically the Gaussian model, because the walks are basically Gaussian walks. And so the model close to four dimensions turns out that you can expand around four dimensions and compute in perturbation theory around four dimensions what the critical exponents are. I'm not saying how you do it. You write the action, you integrate instead of dx, d, you put 4 minus d epsilon, and you expand and you see, oh, it's Gaussian plus some small correction, and you do a bunch of algebra, and you end up with the exponent predicted with precision up to epsilon squared. Right? Now we take n to 0, and now it becomes the self-avoiding walk here. So this should be the correct result for the self-avoiding walk in 4 minus epsilon dimension. It should be 1 half plus epsilon over 16 plus dot, dot, dot. So that's a prediction, that's a derivation, because we derived the duality. People compute this in field theory. We expand and n equal to 0. So that's a prediction. That is correct. Right? This 1 half plus epsilon over 16 is true. And we ask, is this what Flory predicts? And unfortunately, no. This Flory expansion gives 1 half plus epsilon over 12. Right? So, okay, Flory was wrong. Not by much. It's not so different. Right? 12 and 16 is similar. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Good. So, let's see. So we are introducing C, we have C. C is the concentration of polymers and so C is rho divided by n if rho is the concentration of monomers, right? Because the polymer has n monomers, so the concentrations are proportional to each other. Okay? So there I'm using C for the concentration of chains. Now, when do I want to use monomers and when do I want to use polymers? If the box is huge, and if there are not many polymers, then a polymer is like a particle, right? So if I am in a huge box, right, a box is huge, and my density of polymers is small. I have a polymer here, a polymer here, a polymer here, a polymer here, a polymer here. What's the pressure? This you know from thermodynamics. What's the pressure? Well, just PV equal nRT, just a gas. Right? The polymers are small, they're just like particles. Right? So in this limit, in this language, we would have that the pressure as a function of C and then would be equal, so let me divide, let me say this is equal to 1, would be basically the C times KBT. This is just PV equal nRT written in this language, right? V, C is N over volume, so it's P volume equal to NT. Right? So this is what we get if C is small. So in general, we would get this plus order C. And this quantity is nice because you see it's 1, so it's dimensionless. So that's what we should study. So let's define this as the reduced osmotic pressure. So this is called the reduced, in P people in polymers called reduced osmotic pressure. It's nice, it's dimensionless. It goes to one when the density goes to zero, so it's a nice quantity to study. Right? So let's emphasize, this guy is a nice dimensionless quantity. Now, it looks, now the idea is, what can we say about this pi and about this pi tilde from scaling arguments? So we said that in the very dilute case, it becomes this, okay? The pressure is just nt over volume, right? That's the usual gas result, right? So this is just the usual PV equal nRT, right? How we learn in school. And then we ask, what can we say about this? For example, in a regime which is the opposite, when the density is huge, right? I know when the density is very small, what do I know about when the density is huge, which is the extreme opposite, right? Okay, so the idea is to use scaling arguments and to say that, again, we are going to have that this phi tilde is independent of what we means experimentalists, choose as our fundamental unit A. Right? If I use millimeters as my fundamental scale or centimeters or whatever, right? It doesn't matter. The pressure is the pressure. Okay? Like before when we had the Ising model and he said magnetization is magnetization. It doesn't depend on where I am on the RG. It's a physical quantity, right? What is the magnetization of my rock? Right? And so we should ask, what happens when I rescale A by B times A? Again, what are we doing? We are saying that before this was A, this was A, and now I'm saying that this is the new A. I have 2A, and this is the new A, which is B times A. In this example, B would be 2 in this example, for example. Okay? So when I decide to use a different scale, what happens to my concentration? How does my concentration change? How does my concentration change? Well, let's see. So my concentration in my new units, right? Let's see. So I have some particles, right? And I use this scale A. But then if I use the new scale, right? Before, my concentration is how many particles there are here in unit. Now I rescale by twice. How many particles are there in the new unit? 4 times more, right? So when I rescale A by B times A, the concentration changes by C times B to the D, right? In a one unit cell, I get B to the D times more particles. Okay. Okay. And what about the radius? What about the size of my monomers, if the size was 20 units, after I rescale, it becomes 10. So R goes to R over B, right? So if I have a polygon, something of length here, this had length 2, now it has length 1, right? And what does it mean? But R is not here. What we have here is C and N. Right? C and N. But we know that R is related to N by nu. So this condition is equivalent, sorry, to saying that N is rescaled by N times B to the minus 1 over nu. So that when I raise this to the power nu, right, that means that R which scales like n to the nu, goes to r times this n to the nu scales correctly as n to the nu, which is r times 1 over b. Right? In other words, the claim is, if I have my function, and if I do these two things, I'm doing nothing. If I'm just saying that my fundamentals, my concentration changes like this, but what my resolution to see monomers, my number of monomers also changes, what I can catch, then I'm not doing anything. I'm describing the same thing. And therefore, we conclude that my pressure, pi tilde, that I thought was a function of C and N, is equal to a pi tilde of C B to the D, N B to the minus 1 over nu. But this should be independent of B. This should be independent of B. So what is the only option? How could this be independent of B? What should be the dependence on these two variables? So the claim is that this variable, that this function is a function of C over, or C times N to the D nu, okay, over some C zero. But it doesn't depend on C and N independent, it needs to depend on this product only. Right? In other words, you can say it depends on the product, on this product and this ratio. But the ratio transforms, so it doesn't depend on the ratio. And so immediately we learn something very powerful, which is that our reduced osmotic pressure just depends on this combination. Right? So for example, when we go here, and when we say if I have a dilute gas, and I say it's 1 plus order C, right? This order C is something experimentalists could measure. Right? What is this pressure? How does it deviate from the random gas? And what would you find? You would find that, well, if I expand that function, if that function is 1 plus C times something, this must be C times something, that something must be N to the D times nu up to some constant. Right? And so immediately, we predict that if you compute different polymers, you study different materials, different polymers, they all behave in exactly the same way. They deviate from free gas as concentration times N to the D times nu. It's a very strong prediction. But then you can check experimentally and it's correct. Okay. So you just compute this osmotic pressure minus one for various materials, various polymers, solutions. And the claim is that you get all a bunch of curves. And if you rescale them by C0, by one, you just have one parameter for each curve, they all fall exactly on top of each other. It's really a sharp prediction, right? That you know exactly how they scale. So that's an example of the power of scaling. But what's it's even nicer to do, so that's to study the vicinity of one example we know very well. But what I find really powerful is to ask, what about now this example, where I have my polymers here, and they are very, very dense. What about this case, where the density is huge? Right? This a priori, we are really in terra incognita, right? There we know, it's a gas and so on. What happens here, in this huge mess? Yes?
Before we go on, can you just explain how we go from the dependence of C and N to the ratio? I didn't quite follow.
Okay, so the statement was that this must be independent of B, right? And so if it's independent of B, but if my variable transforms like this and this transforms like this, I must make a combination that doesn't transform.
Okay. Okay.
And the trick is to multiply C by N to the D times nu. Because you see, C transforms with B to the D, N to this power transforms exactly in a way to cancel that.
Okay.
Right? So this combination doesn't transform when I rescale B, and therefore, right? So for example, I could say it's a function of this and C. Here I'm not losing any generality, right? I'm just saying this function is a function of this combination and this. But then this transforms, so it cannot depend on this. That's another way of saying, right? So it can only depend on this quantity here. Okay. But now let's see what would we say when C is very large. And let's go back to the pressure. So the pressure now is, according to our definition, C times T times this reduced osmotic pressure that is a function of C N to the D nu up to some constant. Doesn't matter the constant. Now, when the concentration is very small, what makes sense to think is in terms of polymers. Because a polymer is like a particle. But when the concentration is huge, what makes sense is to think in terms of monomers. Right? Because you see, imagine here you have a big polymer. What you see is how many monomers there are. You don't even see where are the polymers ending and beginning, right? We are in the middle of this spaghetti soup, right? What matters is how dense is the spaghetti, not what's the typical size of the spaghetti. That you have no idea. Right? So in this language, when C is very large, we want to go from C to rho. Right? So let's go from C to rho. So let's write that C is rho over n. So this is T times rho over n times some pi tilde. C is rho over n, so rho times n to the D times nu minus 1. Forget this C0. It's not C0. Who cares? Do you agree? I just wrote C as rho over n. I think this is hard to see. I should probably write it. Okay. So what we are arriving is that this pressure here is equal to T times rho over n times pi tilde of rho n to the d nu minus 1 over some constant. Do you agree? Right? I just copied there. This is what we expect. This is true. But now we want to analyze this when C is very big. And now the key idea is when C is very big, what should be the dependence on N? On the size of each polymer when the density is huge. What do you think? Or maybe let me help you. Should it depend on N? What do you think? Imagine you are in the middle of some spaghetti, and you know the density, the mass density in your spaghetti soup, and you are in the middle of the soup, right? Should it matter what's the typical size of the spaghetti? Right? No. You are in the middle of the spaghetti. Who cares if the typical size is 500 or 1,000? What matters is the density of monomers. Right? So this should not depend on N. When C is very big, we should get N independence. It should only depend on rho. Rho, yes, but N, no. So how could this expression be independent of N? This depends on N. So how could it be independent of N? So you see, you have 1 over n times this function. How could the combination be independent of n? Sorry?
The function.
So exactly. So what do you want what function do you want pi tilde of x? What do you want this function to be?
Just
So your answer was correct. She was saying, what's your name? Sorry?
Kaohsiung.
Kaohsiung was saying, I want this pi tilde to scale like n to cancel n. So what should this function pi tilde of this dimensionless quantity pi tilde of x should be? What should this function be? Good. X to the power
1
no, 1 minus d. This doesn't work. If I plug this quantity here, this doesn't scale like n.
You just divide by d mu.
Good. 1 divided by d mu minus 1. And therefore, this is what it must be for this to be independent of n. Right? This is what it must be to have n independence. Now, the n dependence cancels, and we conclude that this quantity is t times rho scales with rho as d times mu over d times mu minus 1. You see how powerful this is. We managed to predict such non-trivial scaling with the density. So I have this monomer soup, compute the pressure in a big box. It scales with the density of monomers with this funny power. So for example, this funny power, it's approximately equal to 9/4 in 3 dimensions. Right? Because if we use 3/5 for, you know, I mean, it's funny power. Nothing special. So this is a very powerful prediction for how does the pressure of a big solution of polymers scales in the limit of very large polymers for some noodle soup, right? So it's I think it's a beautiful example of this power of scaling arguments, right? So again, where were we using scaling arguments? We were saying things scale. So first we started, the pressure is a function of 2 variables. Then we use scaling arguments to say, well, but different people, right? Will those quantities for different people are different. What I call concentration, how many particles there are per unit volume. Someone else calls concentration prime because that other person uses 2 millimeters instead of 1 millimeter as the fundamental scale. And what I call the typical size, the person would call typical size divided by the scaling. And we must agree. And therefore, the function must be invariant under changing our units, which is the first equation, and should be independent of B. And therefore, it doesn't depend really on 2 variables independent. It only depends on this very non-trivial combination. That's the first thing, very powerful. Immediately, we get function of 1 variable. Then it gave us immediately 2 predictions. One prediction is, now, if this quantity is 1 plus something small, if I know that this function is pi tilde of x is 1 plus x plus dot 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 at small x, then immediately I predict that I get ideal gas plus a correction that is proportional to the density with a very precise power of n. That's a prediction. Right? That's what we worked out here. We said it's not any power, it's a very precise power of n that we can predict. Prediction number 1. Right? So that's a prediction. Then we said that at very large density, that's much more non-trivial, this function of 1 variable times this should be independent of n, right? And then we learn that that function that was 1 plus x at small x, it must be like this at x very large, right? When the density is very large. And then, indeed, if that works, that's the only way the n dependence could cancel. And we predict that the pressure divided by the temperature is this simple power of rho. That's something you could check, right? You just put the density of soup and you check that the pressure is given by this, where this is a very non-trivial function. You can now plug nu to be this 3 over d plus 2 and you get some very non-trivial function of the dimension that indeed works beautifully in experiments of polymers that people do everywhere.
I have a question. The pressure. I thought the pressure that's exerted on the box depends on the momentum change when you hit the wall. Where does this relation show up?
It doesn't. it doesn't. So it's true. You're right. The pressure is the response of the, by cha- of changing the volume of the box, right? That's what pressure is, right? It's force per unit per area, right? So we study. It's related to what kind of ensemble do you use? Do we fix the volume, or do we fix the number of particles, or do we fix the energy, and so on? But pressure is pressure. We know what it is, right? It's pressure. It's what strength we need to do to keep the box fixed. And I'm not computing it. I'm just using scaling arguments to predict what it is. Right?
Why don't you need to consider the movement of the particle? But you're just considering the concentration.
You are asking me why don't I do the computation in a given way, but maybe I could ask you what is wrong in the way we did it, right? Do you find anything wrong in the arguments, right? So I said that I have the pressure, and it's a function of the concentration and the volume. I even said when it's very dilute, I know that the pressure is just equal to this. This is a result we know, right, from ideal gas, that the pressure is a volume times temperature, right? PV equal nRT. So that's true. Then I said, but what is the pressure of this soup in general? Not when the density is very small and the polymers are particle, but when the density is big. What would be the pressure in that box? And then I said, I don't know. But then we started using scale learning arguments, and now we know. Okay, that's it.
OK, I think we stop here. So okay, let me just one more. So this
concludes the analysis of random walls and polymers. So not only we finished with random walls, but we really did some scaling arguments and chemistry and so on. And if you remember in the overview in the first lecture, we said we were going to study Ising model, Gaussian model, random walk, and so on. And we did more or less study almost everything we promised, but not everything. So in the last lecture, the only thing I will do is review what I said in the very first lecture of what we promised we were going to study, and indeed summarize and say, indeed, we did this and that and so on, to have a general overview. But that will be quick, because I would like to focus on saying a few words about what we did not cover, just to give you, now that you know the techniques that we would use, just to give you some kind of overview, which is a little bit more technical than the first overview, which was just cartoons. So the purpose tomorrow is just to close everything and to just give a general picture of what have we achieved. And what would we achieve if we had one or two more weeks, the remaining few models that we would touch on? Okay? So tomorrow is just a summary lecture. So if you have general questions, prepare them, and I can also answer tomorrow.